Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Michael Bierer. This week includes studies on promising new therapies for IgA nephropathy, evolving antithrombotic strategies after coronary stenting, and the inciting antigen in rare vaccine-related clotting syndromes. We review the urgent challenge of mucormycosis and follow the case of a young woman with headaches and hypertension. We discuss human subjects research. Perspectives examine rural health, data interoperability, drug labels in the courts, and a pediatrician's dilemma. Sibeprenlimab in IgA nephropathy, interim analysis of a phase 3 trial by Vlado Perkovic from the University of New South Wales, Sydney, and co-authors. IgA nephropathy is a progressive, immune-mediated kidney disease that is typically diagnosed in patients 20 to 40 years of age. It is a leading cause of chronic kidney disease and the most common primary glomerulonephritis. Sibeprenlimab is a humanized IgG2 monoclonal antibody that selectively inhibits the cytokine A proliferation-inducing ligand, APRIL, by preventing it from binding to its receptors. APRIL is considered to be a key driver of the pathogenesis of IgA nephropathy. In this phase 3 trial, 510 patients with biopsy-confirmed IgA nephropathy were randomly assigned to receive either subcutaneous sibeprenlimab or placebo, administered every 4 weeks for 100 weeks. Sibeprenlimab resulted in a significant reduction in proteinuria as compared with placebo in patients with IgA nephropathy. The safety profile appeared to be similar with sibeprenlimab and placebo. A phase 3 trial of atacicept in patients with IgA nephropathy by Richard Lafayette from Stanford University, California, and co-authors. Atacicept is a native human transmembrane activator and calcium modulator and cyclophilin ligand interactor Fc fusion protein that inhibits two key immunoregulatory cytokines, B-cell activating factor, or BAF, and APRIL, considered to be central to the pathophysiology of IgA nephropathy. In this ongoing phase 3 trial, 203 patients with IgA nephropathy were randomly assigned to receive atacicept administered subcutaneously once weekly by patients at home or matching placebo. In this pre-specified interim analysis at 36 weeks, treatment with atacicept resulted in a significantly greater reduction in proteinuria than placebo in patients with IgA nephropathy. Marcello Tonelli from the University of Calgary, Canada, writes in an editorial that the interim findings in the studies by Perkovic and co-authors and Lafayette and co-authors were used to support accelerated approval applications to the Food and Drug Administration. Sibeprenlimab has been provisionally approved, and a decision on atacicept is anticipated shortly. Evaluation of the effect of each agent on the rate of change in eGFR is a condition of full approval, and results will be reported after 24 months of treatment. Assuming that sibeprenlimab and atacicept reduce eGFR loss, other unresolved questions regarding these promising treatments include cost, value for money, access, equity, and long-term safety, especially since galactose-deficient IgA1 levels may rebound once treatment is discontinued. Currently, there is a rapidly growing armamentarium of approved treatments for IgA nephropathy. Although the addition of sibeprenlimab and potentially atacicept is cause for celebration, it further complicates an already complex situation. How, when, and in whom agents such as sibeprenlimab or atacicept should be added to the current guideline-recommended multi-drug regimens is not presently known. Therapy for atrial fibrillation in patients with drug-eluting stents by Seung-Jun Lee from the Severance Hospital, Seoul, South Korea, and co-authors. Among patients with atrial fibrillation who had undergone implantation of a drug-eluting stent, current guidelines recommend early discontinuation of aspirin and continuation of combination therapy, preferably the administration of a non-vitamin K antagonist oral anticoagulant with a P2Y12 inhibitor for 6 to 12 months after percutaneous coronary intervention, PCI. In contrast, these guidelines recommend monotherapy with oral anticoagulants beyond 1 year after PCI when the patient's condition has been stabilized. However, evidence from randomized trials supporting this approach is limited. In this trial in South Korea, 960 patients with atrial fibrillation who had undergone the implantation of a drug-eluting stent at least 1 year earlier were randomly assigned to receive monotherapy with a non-vitamin K antagonist oral anticoagulant or combination therapy oral anticoagulant plus a P2Y12 inhibitor. Among these patients, oral anticoagulant monotherapy was associated with a lower 12-month risk of a composite of death from any cause, myocardial infarction, stent thrombosis, stroke, systemic embolism, or major or clinically relevant non-major bleeding than combination therapy with an oral anticoagulant and a P2Y12 inhibitor. In an editorial, Gregory Lipp and Wukash Kuzma from the University of Liverpool, United Kingdom, write that the trial by Lee and co-authors is consistent with the finding of other randomized trials of these agents and provides additional reassurance that even in patients with atrial fibrillation who have undergone implantation of second or third generation drug-eluting stents, direct oral anticoagulant monotherapy had better efficacy and possibly safety than combination therapy after 1 year. However, other issues are worth considering. For example, many patients have multiple coexisting illnesses and are receiving multiple medications. And the management of atrial fibrillation requires more than the use of oral anticoagulants alone, because a residual risk of stroke and major adverse cardiac events remains evident despite oral anticoagulant use. Thus, contemporary guidelines advocate a holistic or an integrated care management approach for the treatment of atrial fibrillation. In addition, the relatively short follow-up of 1 year may preclude observation of late-onset events, especially in light of changes in risk with aging and incident coexisting illnesses. Adenoviral inciting antigen and somatic hypermutation in VITT by Jingjing Wang from Flinders University, Adelaide, South Australia, and co-authors. Vaccine-induced immune thrombocytopenia and thrombosis, VITT, is a rare prothrombotic complication that can occur after adenoviral vector-based vaccination against COVID-19. In rare cases, it can also occur after natural adenovirus infection. VITT is mediated by platelet-activating antibodies against the highly cationic protein platelet factor 4, PF4. The underlying inciting antigen trigger and immunopathogenesis remain unknown. The results of this study indicate that VITT occurs when, in persons with immunoglobulin light chain allele IGLV3-21*02 or *03, a specific somatic hypermutation develops that affects antibodies that recognize a specific epitope on the adenoviral core protein P7, which results in misdirection of antibody targeting toward PF4. Mucormycosis, a review article by Dimitrios Kontoyanis from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, Houston, and Thomas Walsh from the Center for Innovative Therapeutics and Diagnostics, Richmond, Virginia. Mucormycosis is a rapidly progressive invasive fungal infection that affects patients who are severely immunocompromised, as well as patients with diabetes and persons with immunocompetence who have sustained major trauma. Mucormycosis manifests in several clinical forms, including sinoorbital, rhinocerebral, sinopulmonary, gastrointestinal, cutaneous, musculoskeletal, osteoarticular, and disseminated mucormycosis, as well as single-organ disease. Mucormycosis is often lethal, but early recognition and intervention reduces mortality. Successful treatment depends on early detection and staging of the disease, timely initiation of antifungal therapy, surgical resection of infected tissue, reversal of immunodeficiencies, and correction of metabolic abnormalities. Liposomal amphotericin B is the preferred agent for initial antifungal therapy with oral triazoles as alternative agents. Research on rapid molecular diagnostic strategies, new antifungal agents, host-directed immune augmentation, antivirulence immune therapeutics, and risk-based stratification to inform management of disease may substantially improve outcomes in patients with this highly destructive mycosis. An 18-year-old woman with headache and hypertension, a case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Paul Fadikar and colleagues. An 18-year-old woman presented with worsening, debilitating headaches and severe hypertension. She had a 6-year history of intermittent headaches that progressed to daily morning headaches with nausea, photophobia, and visual symptoms, and later developed morning retching and papilledema. She ultimately arrived at the emergency department with a crushing bitemporal headache, nausea, photophobia, and a blood pressure of 207 over 143 millimeters of mercury, complicated by pulmonary edema and profound hypokalemia. Despite intensive antihypertensive therapy, her blood pressure remained refractory. Evaluation revealed markedly elevated plasma renin activity and a small mass in the left kidney. She was diagnosed with a renanoma, a rare, usually benign juxtaglomerular cell tumor of the kidney that secretes renin and causes hyperreninemic hypertension, hypokalemia, and secondary end organ effects. Surgical resection of the tumor led to resolution of her hypertension and substantial improvement in symptoms. Improving Regulations for Human Subjects Research, a Sounding Board article from the National Academy of Medicine by Linda Coleman from Stanford University, California, and Katie Wullard from the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, Washington, D.C. Scientific research must balance scientific innovation and ethical responsibility. In the United States, however, the regulatory framework for human subjects research has grown increasingly complex and fragmented. This regulatory system was intended to protect research participants, but has expanded to the point where it has delayed study initiation, added administrative complexity, and diverted attention from scientific and ethical imperatives. Pandemic responses, such as Rapid Institutional Review Board, IRB, reviews, accelerated data sharing, and streamlined regulatory decisions demonstrated that agencies and institutions could adapt rules when urgency demanded it. The challenge now is to make such flexibility accessible and sustainable in non-emergency contexts. In September 2025, the National Academies released a report, Simplifying Research Regulations and Policies, Optimizing American Science, that joins a long list of efforts calling for change. The report outlined a series of options to address regulatory challenges, each with pros and cons. In this article, the authors present 3 important challenges within human subjects research regulation that most immediately affect physician scientists, including inconsistent and intersecting requirements, the unintended consequences of single IRBs, and inadequate adaptation to new methods. The Rural Health Transformation Program, an avenue for promoting administrative policies, a perspective by Heather Howard from Princeton University, New Jersey, and Carmel Shakar from Harvard Law School, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Rural health in the United States is in crisis. Decades of hospital closures, clinician shortages, and losses of essential services have left millions of people without reliable access to care and with worsened health outcomes. These challenges will be compounded by the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which makes sweeping changes to health programs, including cutting nearly $1 trillion in federal health care funding. Against this backdrop, the Rural Health Transformation Program, RHTP, has emerged as an opportunity for states to pursue funding for rural health care, although the program's $50 billion in awards will be insufficient to offset these cuts. The success of the RHTP, however, will depend on the ability of states to craft thoughtful, locally informed plans on tight timelines, CMS's willingness to prioritize meaningful investments in care transformation, and states' capacity to follow through on plans now that initial awards have been announced. The program is slated to be rolled out on an ambitious timeline. Physicians and healthcare leaders should be aware that the RHTP is a vehicle for pushing states to rapidly modify their healthcare policies. If implemented effectively, the program could lay the groundwork for sustainable improvements in access to healthcare, workforce stability, and community well-being. But if the process is dominated by political interests or driven by unrelated policy priorities, this opportunity will be lost. The next chapter in healthcare interoperability, a perspective by John Halamka and Mickey Tripathi from the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota. In July 2025, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, announced the Digital Health Ecosystem Initiative, an effort that seeks to accelerate interoperability, expand access to digital tools, and modernize healthcare information technology infrastructure. After decades of federal action, electronic health record adoption expanded to near universal implementation, and nationwide interoperability networks now securely exchange more than 50 million patient records daily. Yet patients and healthcare organizations still confront considerable gaps driven by misalignment between business interests and frictionless data flows. The initiative includes network interoperability, personalized digital tools for patients, and proactive market participation by CMS, with an interoperability framework to support data exchange and efforts such as eliminating redundant paperwork, implementing digital credentials, and proposing a national provider directory. The goal is to rapidly accelerate adoption of already established policies, initiatives, and technologies. However, the authors caution that the initiative does not introduce any new regulatory requirements or incentives, and that without addressing fundamental economic and policy barriers to interoperability, its impact may be short-lived. Drug labels as evidence of patent infringement, a troubling legal trend. A perspective by Paul Gugliuzza from the University of Texas School of Law, Austin, and Jacob Schirkow from the University of Illinois College of Law, Champaign. Drug labeling requirements implemented by the Food and Drug Administration are intended to guide the safe and effective use of prescription drugs. Yet recent federal circuit court decisions have treated statements in drug labels as evidence of patent infringement by generic drug manufacturers, embracing a theory the authors call infringement by label. The court decisions are incorrect and threaten to limit access to affordable generic drugs. Clinicians usually rely on guidelines, experience, and medical literature, not drug labels, when making prescribing decisions. But courts have relied on drug label text to infer that generics manufacturers encouraged, recommended, or promoted patented uses. Even when drug companies adopt a skinny label, courts have treated warnings, clinical trial descriptions, and statements of equivalence as inducement. The result is increased uncertainty for generics manufacturers who may delay product launches, leading to prolonged periods of high prices and limited access to essential medicines. The authors argue that FDA-required labeling language cannot alone show patent infringement and urge courts to consider actual prescribing behavior, not a regulatory drug label document that many physicians don't routinely consult. A pediatrician's dilemma, pushing back against CDC guidance in the exam room. A perspective by Dorothy Novick from Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. The little girl hops between the colored tiles of the exam room floor as her mother says no to all vaccines. The CDC says they're looking at the data, the mother explains. Who knows what they'll decide? The mother leans back in her chair, hands spread over her pregnant belly. Dr. Novick finds herself, unexpectedly, at a loss for words. It's not the crushing defeat of hearing this mother's previous vaccine hesitancy evolve into flat-out refusal. It is the invoking of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. The agency Dr. Novick has quoted to families as the final authority, the standard for evidence-based recommendations, is now the mother's source of reckless, life-threatening misinformation and guidance. Dr. Novick chooses her words carefully, determined to focus on the evidence. What's happening can be so confusing, and I know there are mixed messages, Dr. Novick tries. Then why, the mother wants to know, would the CDC say that MMR might cause autism? It's impossible to know who to believe and who not to. Dr. Novick offers the American Academy of Pediatrics as a reliable source of information. She offers her own practice, where the mother's extended family comes for care, and the world-renowned experts at the hospital, a deeply respected institution in their city. Dr. Novick reminds herself that the mother's concerns are driven by love and a fierce protective instinct, and Dr. Novick is preparing to weigh in with reassuring evidence when the mother says she regrets the vaccines her daughter has received. The baby will not be getting any. I want to be sure you've heard that the CDC no longer has a panel of vaccine experts making decisions, and their new guidance isn't based on the facts. Dr. Novick adds that this is not just her personal view, invoking the AAP's recent release of its own vaccine schedule. The mother remains resolute, and a palpable new tension fills the room. The options before Dr. Novick are clear. She can continue to offer her professional expertise and risk disrupting a therapeutic relationship that has spanned the mother's lifetime and her own career. She can explain that she is no longer comfortable caring for her children, an approach to vaccine refusal that is now accepted by the AAP for cases in which other avenues have been exhausted. Or she can warm the room in hopes of a more productive discussion next time. Dr. Novick shifts the conversation to the daughter's upcoming dance recital, and they both stand up to make plans for the baby's arrival as the visit comes to an end. As pediatricians trying to protect children from the newly threatening CDC, we are walking multiple fine lines at once, like some sort of high-wire circus act. In our Images in Clinical Medicine, a 49-year-old man with acute myeloid leukemia was evaluated for prolonged neutropenic fever. On examination, there were crackles at the lung bases. CT of the chest revealed a reversed halo sign. A PCR assay for Mucorales species in bronchoalveolar lavage fluid was positive. Pulmonary mucormycosis was diagnosed. In another image, a 60-year-old man presented with a 15-day history of generalized weakness and right upper abdominal pain. Imaging studies revealed diffuse disruption of the hepatic architecture by hyperechoic nodules and areas of necrosis and hemorrhage, which produced a mosaic pattern of enhancement. A diagnosis of hepatic angiosarcoma, a rare, highly aggressive primary malignant vascular tumor of the liver, was made. Hepatic angiosarcoma is associated with exposure to vinyl chloride, arsenic, or anabolic steroids, which this patient did not have. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.